Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. This is the first of the new order of commentary podcasts. We are going to be coming to you twice a week. Today is Friday, September 23rd. That's when we're taping this. I'm here, John Podhoretz, editor of commentary. With me, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hello, John.
Commentary Magazine, the 71-year-old monthly of opinion, analysis, and intellectual rigor. Please follow us at commentary on Twitter. Go to our Facebook page and give us a like at commentary. Join us by subscribing at commentarymagazine.com. You get a couple of free reads. Then you get to subscribe at $19.95 for a full year of all digital access, or $29.95 gets you everything we got, plus our beautiful monthly magazine. Our new issue just came hot off the presses today with a splendid article called How Bad is the Great American Slowdown by James Pethakoukas, and some other really great stuff there. But of course, we're here on the eve of pre-debate weekend, the big fight, the big matchup, the big kahuna, Hillary versus Trump. There is an interesting division of perception between those of us who follow politics on a granular minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis on social media and in the news, and everybody else on Earth who's rational and normal and isn't psychotic and lives a normal life instead of living the way we live in this lunatic hothouse. And I think everybody who is living granularly is so buffeted about by all of the numbers and polls and multiplicity of polls and following the stuff so close that we have come to a false error in perception, which is somehow that, you know, Trump is now leading, Trump is now on the offensive, this is now Trump's race to lose. And it's actually very important for everybody to know going into this election that Hillary is leading. Hillary is leading by a couple of points in the Real Clear Politics average. She is leading by 50 certain electoral votes in states that we can confidently assign to her or to Trump. And if you take every poll and you disallow any possibility of lunatic freak things happening, right now she would win 272 electoral votes and he would win 266 and she would be the president. So by any rational measure, Hillary Clinton is in the lead, but it doesn't feel like Hillary Clinton is in the lead right now.
No, not just because of polls. On the national level, we have a variety of national surveys that show the race moving in Hillary's direction, to the point of we have like two polls, I think, that show it plus six or plus seven, depending on the four-way. I mean, that's a blowout.
And this is after last week, where the polls really, even the national polls, really tightened.
Yeah, we're returning to pre-pneumonia equilibrium. Now, on the state level, you have polls still showing movement in Donald Trump's direction, particularly in states that Democrats even just left. They thought they were so clear and leading toward Hillary Clinton victory, like Colorado and Virginia. Those races are tightening. And you have places like Ohio, which you have a couple of polls showing Donald Trump leading by 5 points. And it doesn't make any sense that you have a race that's plus seven Hillary nationally and plus five in Ohio for Donald Trump.
Or plus nine in New Hampshire for Hillary. And
even in a realignment election.
Right.
Like, it's just weird.
So what we have here is, in the data that we're all being required to use, data are not agreeing. The state polls are not agreeing with the national polls, which did happen to some degree in the Romney versus Obama race, but not to this degree, not with these swings.
More, it's not just the polls that make us feel like Donald Trump has the momentum. The behavior of Hillary Clinton, and particularly Clinton surrogates like the president, Barack Obama, are acting like they're down. They're behaving like they have the wind at their heads and they're just fighting into a storm. And that might be a contrivance, but it's hard to ignore the fact that the Trump campaign definitely appears to be acting like they know they're up. They're probably talking internally like they're up, and Hillary Clinton's campaign is talking like they're down.
Well, I mean, when you see numbers like Colorado, where there's at least one poll now that has them tied in Colorado, whereas she was up by 15 in most polling, and his numbers in Colorado were, I don't know, a month ago, like in the high 20s, like 29 or 31 or something like that. And there is a poll out from Quinnipiac that has them tied at 47. That seems very suspicious to me. And I have to say that one of the things that's happened, and this is where we get technical and not political, is that over the last week and a half, these pollsters are now applying what is called a likely voter screen. That is to say, they are not simply polling people who are registered voters to tell them that they're registered, but they ask them a series of questions to determine whether they are likely voters. Did they vote before? Who did they vote for before? What party are they? Ask questions that seem to solidify that they are likely voters. And the likely voter screen is a much more complicated thing than the registered voter screen, because what you're doing, then you start applying theories about what the electorate is going to look like and what size the electorate will be and how much of the electorate will be Republican, how much of it will be Democratic, how much of it will be undecided. And that's where things start getting kinky, because clearly many of these pollsters are in wild disagreement about what the electorate is going to look like in 2016. They were pretty accurate in 2012, but remember, in 2012, though a lot of us were saying maybe they're not, and the electorate's too Democratic and not Republican enough, Obama was on the ticket in 2012 just as he had been in 2008. 70 million people had voted for him in 2012. Assuming that those people might come out and vote for him again was a rational assumption. And in fact, you know, 95% of them did. So it's a weird situation that we're in, because he's not on the ticket. Hillary can't expect his vote. Trump can't expect the normal Republican coalition vote because he's not getting all of Republicans. But maybe he's getting these hidden voters who haven't voted before. And so the Trump-friendlier pollsters, like Quinnipiac and Fox News, are describing or are imagining an electorate that is more Trumpian. And the other pollsters, like Monmouth College and some of the national pollsters, are imagining an electorate that looks more like 2012. And so we have no idea. We'll never have the foggiest idea until Election Day who's right. Because that's the problem here. The polling on likely voter polling is based on theories about something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and Nate Silver said that very thing today or yesterday, and he also he said that this election year in particular, there's going to be an accuracy problem, and he also attributed it to the strange appeal of Trump. Who's voting for him? Not just the strange nature of the electorate, but being unsure exactly who's going to come out for him.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, we're talking about in some of these polls, when you don't push people, you got 18%, 17, 18% undecided. We haven't seen these numbers in a quarter century. They don't really make sense. It doesn't make sense that 18% of people are undecided. Either they're going to vote, in which case they will align probably pretty closely to the way everybody else is aligning. That's what usually happens with undecideds. It used to be that they broke for the challenger. Then it started that they were breaking for the incumbent. So nobody knows who they break for, number one. And that's only if they're genuinely undecided. And secondly, like, maybe a lot of them aren't going to vote at all. And if they're not going to vote at all, then they can't. Then they're being in the poll skews the poll, because the numbers mathematically have to add up to 100. So if you have 5% of respondents in these polls who actually aren't going to turn out, there shouldn't be reflected in the poll at all. But we won't know any of this until the election is held. So people are flying blind. However, there are assumptions that we can make based on things that we know. And some of them have to do with this question of enthusiasm versus turnout. Noah, maybe you want to talk a little about that.
Well, I mean, you could gauge from the truly scientific method is to gauge crowd sizes. You have to look at the crowd size and determine, you know, who has the most enthusiasm. No, I'm kidding. That's nonsense. We can actually identify in polls who has the more enthusiastic base. And some surveys have suggested that Donald Trump has a modest advantage among Republicans who are enthusiastic about turning out for him. He has a problem, however, because all Republicans aren't going to vote for him. Hillary Clinton has an enthusiasm problem, but it's way overstated. She has the enthusiasm of like 80-something, according to one recent survey, 80-something of Democrats who are turning out for her, and then another 12 15%, something like that, aren't especially enthusiastic and might not even show up. Now, this is about a 5 to 10 point advantage for Donald Trump in the form of enthusiasm. But whether or not that materializes on election day, it doesn't just happen naturally. It can, but it's rare. We understand that Donald Trump doesn't have a turnout machine. He doesn't have a GOTV operation. In fact, he's outsourced a lot of that to the Republican National Committee, to senatorial races, and to state-level parties. A lot of these state-level parties don't even like him, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who is relying on Barack Obama's data analytics operation and GOTV, which performed very well. She's also relying on the Obama coalition, and as the Cook Political Report analyst Amy Walter pointed out today, that precisely one Democrat has ever been elected on the back of Barack Obama's coalition, and that is Barack Obama. They have failed miserably to duplicate Barack Obama's success every time they've been relied on, in 2010, in 2014, and it looks like 2016. They're just not going to materialize. So she needs her own coalition. And it does appear right now that she's got it. Again, going back to what we were discussing before, the surveys suggest that she's winning rather comfortably on a national level, and she can rely on outperforming her polling probably by a point or two if Barack Obama's machine performs as we expect it to perform.
Remember, the machine is not the coalition. The machine is a get-out-the-vote coalition, and what happened in 2012 when Obama was running, and this is a key point about the enthusiasm problem, is that the Obama Democratic turnout machine turned out voters who were unenthusiastic about voting for Obama. That was his margin of victory. He pulled out people who, when asked on a scale of 1 to 10, are you enthusiastic about voting, said 1 to 2, and he got those people to the polls. They got those people to the polls. If they can duplicate that, so that means these are people who didn't particularly like Obama, but were dragged to the polls anyway. Hillary is in exactly the same situation. She has an unenthusiastic, Romney beat Obama in enthusiasm. Republicans were ready to drag themselves over glass to go to the polls, and he didn't win. And there was a whole conspiracy theory that he had left, you know, millions of missing white votes on the table, and every statistical analysis that, you know, suggests maybe there were a couple hundred thousand people in Ohio, but not enough even to turn Ohio to his advantage.
And that's why this enthusiasm thing is kind of is misleading, and you have Trump supporters who are very eager to point to rallies and what have you, because he has an edge in terms of enthusiasm. His voters are thrilled to vote for them, for him rather. There's just not enough of them.
Now, it's like one of the stunning numbers in these polls has Hillary, this is I think in the NBC News poll, has Hillary, when you ask who is honest and trustworthy, Hillary at a historic low for any presidential candidate of 31% and Trump at 41%. Now, this is one of the things that makes liberals pull their hair out, because it's like Trump's a pathological liar. Okay, whatever you might say about Hillary, he's worse. I mean, he says anything about his businesses. He lies from morning till night. What is this about? Well, it's about how Trump, I think this is a misunderstanding of what people are responding to when they're asked about honesty and trustworthiness. What they mean is that Trump says what he, you know, Trump tells it like it is, and Trump is willing to say things that other people aren't willing to say, and Hillary prevaricates, and she calibrates her answers, and she's suspicious, you know, and she litigates and all that. None of that, I mean, of course, it would be much better for Hillary if she were 15 points better in this number, but that's not going to keep people from voting for her. Most of the people who say that she's not trustworthy are 100% of Republicans, and they wouldn't vote for her anyway. So the question, again, is, you know, are we looking at these measures and we're trying to discern, we're trying to view this as a, if you view it as a conventional election, she's winning. If you view it as an unconventional election, that's the only way that he wins. But even if you view it in his terms as an unconventional election, the things that he's getting praised for aren't necessarily going to get him votes.
And in those very polls that ask people about who's more trustworthy or who's less trustworthy, among the same population polled, she beats him in double digits on the question of who's fit for the office.
Yeah, so, I mean, more than double digits, right. Like 20, 25% we're talking about. That means that every Democrat says it, and then some combination of Republicans and undecideds or independents are saying it as well. And that's a significant number. It's still the case that something like 60% of people in some of these polls say they will never vote for him. Now, that doesn't jibe with him getting more than 40%. But, you know, no one's ever run with these numbers. So he really does have to, you really do have to believe that he has an electorate that is not quite revealing itself, certainly nationally, is not revealing itself in these polls to win. And that would be kind of extraordinary. I mean, this is a country that we go over with a fine-tooth comb. And granted, there were these weird things like how nobody could find somebody who was going to vote for Trump in New Hampshire during the Republican primaries, even though he was getting 30, 35% in the polls. And all these Republican officials said, I don't know anybody who was going to vote for him. But assuming that he's going to pull that off, that's not the, you know, that's not like the safe assumption. The safe assumption is that the data say that she's got a small lead and that she's got a relatively significant lead in the Electoral College. And even if everything breaks his way, he doesn't win right now.
Well, there was no hidden Trump vote in the primaries.
I'm not talking about the primaries. No, there was a hidden vote in the sense that, right, it was reflected in the polling. It was that it wasn't reflected anecdotally. Like Republican officials in New Hampshire said, I don't know where all these Trump voters are. I've been doing this for 30 years. I canvass my neighborhood. No one's telling me they're voting for Trump. You know, I mean, it was kind of an amazing thing.
But it still needs to be said, because this is another thing that Trump supporters are comforting themselves with, is the fact that they think that there is this hidden Trump vote where Trump is so socially unacceptable to support that he performs, his performance is better in online surveys or surveys where you're talking to a robot as opposed to a live caller. That's not true. That is not borne out by the data. Actually, Donald Trump performs better in live caller surveys. They say that there will be this electorate that turns out that is just not revealing itself now to pollsters. That's not true in the primaries. Donald Trump supporters were very vocal about their support for him, and in a lot of places he actually underperformed his polls, not by a lot, but there's some.
Oh, and the underperformance, we should go to the underperformance question, because it is a significant fact that Trump is underperforming Republican senatorial candidates in almost every state in which they are running in competitive races. In Florida, Rubio versus Murphy. In New Hampshire, Ayotte versus Hassan. In Pennsylvania, Toomey versus McGinty. And most especially in Ohio, Portman versus Strickland, where Rob Portman, who is a really quite a brilliant politician and running a spectacularly good campaign, has basically put Strickland away. And you know, they're running and Burr and I can't remember what Burr's rival's name is. Whatever.
That's revealing in and of
Hogan?
Itself.
Anyway. Right. But I mean, the point is that they're all running ahead of Trump. Now that suggests, by the way, there's a Republican vote that isn't turning out for Trump that he might be able to get home, that's saying they're gonna vote for these more acceptable Republicans statewide that they know. Or that, you know, he's getting all the Republican votes, and that the Democrats who cross over to vote for Republicans in some of these states, or the independents, are perfectly happy to vote conventionally for the Republicans they've been voting for in midterms, and even in, you know, because this is in the Senate case, that was a midterm election in 10 that they're all now running for re-election for in 16. And maybe he's not getting any more of the vote than that. Again, all these things are that we don't know. All we know as a practical matter is if you average all the polls and you do all the counting and you do this and you do that, she's ahead and he's not. And it's important to keep that in mind, I think, because, you know, we're just getting a false sense of this. She's a terrible candidate. He's a better candidate than she is, in the sense that, you know, right now, if you're a Democrat, you're more worried when she opens her mouth than when he opens his mouth. I think, if you're being honest, like this videotape that she made for a union meeting in Las Vegas, in which she started screeching and saying, you know, why am I not ahead by 50 points, you may ask, was one of the worst political performances I've ever seen. And that was this week. That was Monday or Tuesday. Like, if you're a serious Democrat, you're looking at that, you like want to go climb under the table and cry. I think.
But there is an argument also to be made that he's, in his own way, a terrible candidate in the way people are saying he's good. And by that I mean he hasn't capitalized sufficiently on what was an atrocious string of weeks for her. I mean, he got a little blip for a while after all the revelations after her nine after she collapsed on camera on the anniversary of 9/11, and now we're right back to her having a comfortable lead.
Everybody knows where I stand on this, and right. It's going to make everybody frustrated.
Okay, let's talk again. So Noah, now finally, he right. wants to tell you that the AP poll, the online poll, is a really good poll because the AP poll, which I was just saying to him, is a problematic poll because it's all online, he loves because it proves the point that he's been trying to make since September 10th, or September 12th, which is, Noah?
Which is that Donald Trump had a bunch of riches. He had too many options from which to choose to attack Hillary Clinton on. He had health. He had the gaffe about his supporters being deplorables. He had a bunch of lies about pneumonia and what have you. So he didn't know really where to go. And his campaign's decision was to ignore the health issue and all the associated lies, which, by the way, are Hillary Clinton's biggest weakness. Voters don't trust her. And the deplorables issue, where she said half of Donald Trump's supporters are deplorables. Now, she apologized for saying half of his supporters are deplorables, but she didn't apologize for deplorables. She used the word deplorables 5 or 6 times in the statement about her apology. She's been making this a campaign issue. She delivered a speech about the alt-right, about how they were repulsive, irredeemable racists. She made a web video about how the KKK is supporting Donald Trump. It's a campaign theme for her to say, Donald Trump supporters, half of them are deplorable, and you don't want to associate yourself with that. And guess what? She managed somehow, through really elementary reverse psychology, to get Donald Trump supporters to self-identify as deplorable. And according to this AP poll, which John doesn't like, but I'm perfectly happy to embrace fully, suggests that the deplorable thing doesn't redound to Donald Trump's benefit whatsoever. In fact, a whole 80-something percent of Hillary Clinton supporters agree. And then of the total electorate, it's like 60-something believe that Donald Trump supporters are more racist than not. So, yeah, I think it does actually redound to Hillary Clinton's benefit to be making Donald Trump's supporters an issue, because then you have to make this whether or not you want to jump in this quote-unquote basket with Donald Trump supporters.
You know, what we don't know is what's baked in the cake. What I mean by that is we don't know whether issues that are coming up now, including the response to the bombing in New York or what's going on with the police shootings in Charlotte and Tulsa and all of that, whether they will have a course-affecting change on the election by dint of the way the candidates respond to them, or whether everything that needs to be known about these candidates is known. Hillary is the most famous person ever to run for president. She's been a public official for 25 years. You know who she is, even if you don't know where she stands on every issue. And, you know, if you like her, you like her. If you don't like her, you don't like her. If she's acceptable to you, she's acceptable to you. Trump has been the most dominant figure in the news for almost a year and a half, and probably the same is by now true of him. And we only have one major example that we can pinpoint of a moment in an election in the last 6 weeks that really changed almost changed the election. And that was the revelation the week before the election in 2000 that George Bush had this drunk driving incident in 1976 that he had covered up and hadn't revealed to anybody, which supposedly cratered his evangelical vote by a couple million votes, and therefore might have indeed, you know, led to the Florida mess, the 36 days of Florida. Because, you know, 5,000 evangelicals didn't vote for him in Florida because of the drunk driving conviction, that was enough to create the conditions that led to the hanging Chad nightmare. That is the only event that you can point to as a simple matter of fact after Labor Day, and the famous after Labor Day, the race stabilizes thing, that might have had an effect on a significant number of votes? I mean, I've been following this since, you know, 1980. I can't think of anything in 76, 80, 84, 88, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, or now. You know, maybe you could say Hurricane Sandy, you know, froze the race while Romney was had momentum the last week. But there's no evidence of that.
Well, New Hampshire moved a lot after Sandy.
Yeah, but he didn't need New Hampshire. Yeah, so Romney would have won New Hampshire, and then he would have won.
Even then, who knows?
But then he would have. Then Obama would have had 328 right. instead of 332 right. electoral
votes. The Northeast was a hotbed of.
Yeah, so support. I'm just saying, like, there isn't that much evidence for that. And so I just don't, you know, you just can't say that anything that's going to happen, including these events, which by definition aren't that huge. I mean, that's the odd thing, of course, is there was a terrorist event in New York that didn't do that much harm, right? And there's a police shooting in Charlotte, but it's one person shot by one cop. And, you know, there's a lot of unrest, and there are some hideous videos coming out of you know, sort of racial crime in response to the shooting. But the notion that that's going to, that 2 million people are going to say, okay, I'm voting for Trump now because of this, you know, video I see on my Facebook page. Maybe it's true, but I kind of doubt it. I mean, as we always say, maybe it'll happen, but all of political history suggests otherwise. And unless something really huge happens, I mean, really huge, like a major terrorist event. And then again, you don't know whose benefit it redounds to. We're still, here we are, it's been, you know, we're now 6 or 7 days after, 6 days after the bombing in New York, right? I think it's 6 days as we speak. And
Saturday.
Yeah, so it's 6 days as we speak. And, you know, I don't think the polling suggests that it was of any benefit to Trump, which is the constant hope of the Trumpians and worry of the non-Trumpians is that terrorism is going to help him.
Well, we got news breaking last night that Donald Trump certainly, in my opinion, Donald Trump seems to think that the North Carolina violence, racial violence, is going to benefit him because the day after the debate, he's planning on making a trip down there to highlight his, you know, his particular position on racial violence and inner cities being nightmarish hellscapes from which there is no escape possible, and Afghanistan is a preferable destination to raise your children.
Well, I mean, now we see...
But the debate is going to be what's dominating.
Now we see the noxious cleverness, by the way, of this appeal and how double-edged it is and what its real purpose is, right? So Trump has been saying, you know, black people should vote for me, African Americans should vote for me because everything is so terrible. Why not? Could it get any worse? And now this is, and their lives are hell, and everything is a nightmare. And now you see Charlotte, and that proves it. Well, that's not a message for African Americans. It's a message for white people who see this footage and are terrified by it and worried that a race war is starting against them. And so if you can cast it in this peculiarly condescending, negative way, positive way, as compassion for the suffering people, you know, of the inner city, as opposed to, you know, like what Jesse Helms would have done, which is to say they're and like this congressman whose name I can't remember, this disgusting North Carolina congressman who said, you know, this just proves that black people hate white people because white people are successful. I mean, that's the old way to do it. It's come at it pretty head on. He's doing it in this kind of corkscrew way. And
also a national policy of stop and frisk. He said we needed a national policy of stop and frisk. And then he walked it back and said we only need it in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then he said, I never said what I said, which is on tape. But yeah, obviously, as you said,
this whole notion now that it's just outrageous for him to defend stop and frisk is, of course, ridiculous. Stop and frisk was an extremely successful policy that was probably taken a couple of years too far and went a couple of years too long at the point at which crime had dropped to such a level that you were really not going to you're really not going to produce the kind of numbers, not in terms of confiscation of weapons, but also in terms of the deterrent effect represented by the notion that you couldn't carry a gun around because you never knew if a cop was going to stop you or not. But, you know, it was wildly successful. It's not stupid of him to have brought up stop and frisk. Saying that it should be national was ridiculous, since no policing is not national.
But the disconnect for me, though, is that if you're talking about violence associated with protesters and with Black Lives Matter, that's not a question of increased inner-city violence. That's a political movement that's producing unrest. So
exactly,
not-
and the police chief of Charlotte said that the overwhelming majority of the people that they were arresting had out-of-state driver's licenses. That in fact you had a situation in which people were coming into Charlotte to protest and foment violence. That these weren't locals in Charlotte that they were arresting, which is pretty horrifying if you think about it. I mean, it's one thing. For decades, this has been a line that police have used about protest. You know, outside agitators, people coming from elsewhere. In the 60s, that was used to mean, you know, like white people going to Mississippi to Freedom Riders to help, you know, which was obviously a very noble thing to do. But in this case, if you actually have Black Lives Matter importing people to kind of burn things down, I mean, attacking Black Lives Matter as a dangerous new force in American politics and American life that is being lionized by liberals and leftists and getting a night at the Democratic convention to celebrate itself, you know, that's sensible politics and a serious point, you know. And but of course, Trump doesn't make serious points. He takes serious points, he turns them into caricature, and then he sells the caricature. Now, whether he does that because that's all he has, or whether there's something more, you know, gut smart about it, that this is the only way people are going to take it, that is a question for, you know, history to answer, I think.
But anyway, I don't know if that's going to really register at all, because we're talking about the post-debate narrative. I mean, he's literally trying to news cycle maintenance here preemptively, because it's coming on the heels of the first debate, which is going to be a media spectacle. They're anticipating possibly 100 million people might watch this thing. An absurd amount of people.
Well,
there's
a football game. There's a football game on, so it's not going to be 100 million people. There is an NFL football game on the same night. But having said that, everybody is playing the refs. Like, it's hilarious to watch people accusing. I mean, I keep seeing now on Twitter people accusing Trump of playing the refs, and because for 3 weeks all talk was the moderator has to be a fact-checking attack machine against Trump. And if he wasn't that, then you were going to take him and you were going to throw him in the garbage can like Matt Lauer or Jimmy Fallon or something like that. That was what the moderator said. You're just going to let him lie and no one's going to answer for it. And then, you know, when Chris Wallace said, I'm not there to fact-check, that's for the candidate to do. So if Trump tells a lie, it's for Hillary to say, that's a lie. What you just said is a lie. I'm not the fact checker. And everybody and the entire liberal establishment came down on his head like a ton of bricks. They were playing. That was gaming the refs. That was trying to talk Lester Holt and whoever else, I can't remember who it is, Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper or something like that, to basically take an aggressive anti-Trump stance at the debates, on the grounds that they argue with a straight face that it is okay for the refs to be biased in favor of Hillary because Trump is a unique threat, and therefore it is morally appropriate for the people who are just simply supposed to sit there and ask the questions to become participants in the debate.
Yeah, not only would that backfire if they were getting off the referee's chair to jump all over whatever Donald Trump had to say, especially considering that media fact-checking is itself a subjective practice 9 times out of 10. Now you had reports in, like, NBC News last night I saw where the Clinton machine is developing its post-debate plan, which includes a campaign of shaming directed at individuals in the press and the pundit corps who gauge Trump on absurdly low levels of expectations, like he just managed to stand there for 90 minutes and that was acceptable because who knows. If they and on the heels of this New York Times report, which notes that the Hillary machine, the outrage machine led by a guy named Peter Dow and
David Brock,
they're not really well-liked in the press corps. And for them to gang up on reporters and pundits post-fact just for giving an honest opinion, you can absolutely see how that would result in a backlash, a negative opinion against Hillary Clinton.
I do not agree with you. I think that the campaign against Matt Lauer and against Jimmy Fallon, against all these guys, is very effective. It scares the daylights out of people like Lester Holt. This is the world Lester Holt lives in. He does not want to be accused of having somehow led to Donald Trump's election or having been a powder puff and stuff like that. And is he going to be tougher in that debate? I don't know. I don't care. It's not of interest to me, to be honest. I just think it's hilarious. So that's the liberals saying Trump's gaming it. And Trump is gaming it. So Trump's form of gaming it is to say, they're all going to be unfair to me, so I can't win. So that's just the way it is, and they're all going to be unfair to me. Now, it is arguable that the first debate, the first Republican debate, which created the famous controversy between Trump and Megyn Kelly came out of the gate like a, you know, came out of the gate with guns blazing. She said, you've said this about women and that about women and the other thing about women, and you said this, and are you ready to apologize? Like, that was how she started. And why did she do it? Because the other Republicans had been gaming the refs and saying, you know, Fox, or Democrats who have been saying Fox is just in the tank for Trump, and Fox is hosting the first debate, and Fox is just going to, like, hand everything to Trump. And so Megyn Kelly went after Trump. And, you know, so it works, the gaming the refs. I'm sorry, because we all live in the real world, and this is what happens. But none of it's going to matter, because either the debates will have a political effect or they won't. An audience this large is going to make up its own mind, and it's not going to be, its view of who won the debate is not going to be stirred by 500,000 people who watch CNN, you know, the next day.
You know, and strangely enough, If the moderators feel now obliged to be fact checkers, it could hurt Hillary in a way that it can't hurt Trump, in that Trump doesn't offer enough specifics to fact check and disprove. If you speak in generalities, it can be hard to even nail down where, if he says very bad things happen, you can't say, before a minute ago, you said very bad things happened, and that's not true. Hillary is going to be armed with data and wonky stuff, right. and she's more open to.
But if he says, I opposed the Iraq war, and Lester Holt says, no, you didn't, and then he says, yes, I did, and they go back and forth, and he
Holt
becomes
says,
the subject
let's run
of it.
This, here, let's run this footage, which they did in some of the Republican debates, remember? Like, it's like, let's go to the film
in
clip.
In the Republican debates. In a general election debate, that's unheard of.
That's right. But That's not what he's at risk of. What he is at risk of is somebody saying, you know, Mr. Trump, your foundation, you have not given a dollar to your foundation since 2008. It has spent $1.5 million at Trump properties, effectively meaning that your foundation is giving money to your business using funds that came from other foundations. Is that, how on earth can you defend that? And then he'll say, that's not true. And then the question is, does Lester Holt say, yes, it is true, and you've just told a lie to the American people? Now, he's not going to do that, I don't think, but that is where Trump's vulnerability is. Trump's vulnerability is that when there were 16 people on stage and he was one of 16 and he lied, they all had their own agendas. They were all trying, every one of them, everybody he was debating against wanted their own 5 minutes to make their own points and not engage him personally. Hillary's entire campaign is a dagger aimed at his heart. She is armed with every piece of fact, I assume. She will be armed with every piece of fact to say, what you just said about your foundation's a lie, and then he can say, well, your foundation was no sweet-smelling... So, and she'll say, the Ford Foundation found that my foundation's AIDS initiative saved 10,000 lives, while your foundation bought a painting of you and you hung it at Mar-a-Lago. Like, that's where she can really take him down, because it's one-on-one, and it's... he was used to getting away with it. He gets away, you know, he gets away with it. Who does he talk to on television? He talks to Sean Hannity and Fox and Friends, and neither of whom ever question a single thing that he says. And he's not, he will not be used to it, and he may not perform well.
If you believe the debate prep stories, and I do, because there's tens of them, and they all point to the exact same conclusion, that Donald Trump is not doing very much preparation, to the point where he's actually adding rallies over this weekend that was supposed to be devoted entirely to debate prep. There are some people who think this is a grand disinformation campaign that's led a lot of reporters by the nose into putting out a narrative that Donald Trump wants, which is that he's going to come on stage, be naive and poorly prepared and easily cowed, and he's actually going to show up pretty well prepared and shock everybody with his pretty good performance and outmatch expectations and be judged accordingly. But if you believe the reports, which are that he doesn't have a lectern, that he's not using a surrogate
in debate preparation.
He's not using a surrogate to play Hillary Clinton, that he sits around with his aides, according to NBC's Ali Vitali. He sits around with aides and they kind of throw questions at him and he like fields the questions in sort of a extemporaneous fashion. This isn't debate prep. That sounds like fun. And I imagine that he's going to show up.
I think this
pretty
is not
poorly prepared.
I think this is not irrational for him in this sense. He is who he is, and he got where he got the way he got there. And it's like saying to somebody, okay, you're a pop singer and you have 7 number one hits, but what you need to win this thing is to sing an aria. So we're going to go off for 3 and we're going to teach you how to sing Nessun Dorma, and you'll sing Nessun Dorma. And as long as you're not off key, everyone will think you're great. And he's like, I'm not going to sing Nessun Dorma. Let her sing Nessun Dorma. I'm going to be me. Now, he has been less himself since the big campaign switch in August, because I think this moment hit when it became clear to him that if he was going to stay on the same course, same approach, the combative, always in your face approach, always trying to push that he was going to be humiliated. And so he switched gears. But that doesn't mean that he's a different person, that he's going to show up like a wonk or something like that. That's what Sarah Palin had to do in 2008. She had to go and show that she wasn't a complete ignoramus in the debate with Biden. And she kind of pulled it off, actually. So she went home and she studied like a good, you know, like a good student. She studied and studied and studied and studied the briefing books. What is he going to do with a briefing book? What's he going to do when he says, I was, you know, Prime Minister Galachapalong of Thailand is really one of the best spokesmen for his blah. You know, that's not his thing, and he'll live and die based on who he is. So he might as well just be who he is. The question is temperament. The question is whether he will be able to come across not like a crazy person. And the same is true for her. If she looks like she did in that video to the unions on this week, that is not going to be good for her. I mean, she looked like she was yelling at a, you know, she was like giving a speech at a school and yelling at everybody.
Which means that for all the hype, for the spectacular that this is supposed to be, it could actually be an exquisite dud, because if he's concerned about not sounding like the crazy Trump, and if she's now concerned of not repeating the union video performance, they could both be so guarded.
Right. Except if you use him as the entertainment model for him, right? This is the biggest concert of his life. He's not going to perform his greatest hits. What's he going to do? He's going to do covers? I mean, he's going to try to do his greatest hits. He's going to try to pull off some, you know, he's going to say things like, we're not so politically correct. And, you know, he's going to say, that's what you're doing there is you're being very politically correct. That's not who I am. We need to be able to talk about these things without all this political correct and that stuff. Which would be fine as long as he stops there. But
right.
if he then has to riff on it, or, you know, he tries to, if you want to continue the analogy, he wants to like go into a Grateful Dead 10-minute improv,
right,
based on cocaine, then God knows what'll happen.
And this is also where the fact-checking stuff, especially as it pertains to his foundation and whatnot, can get to him, can knock him off his game, because he takes that personally and he gets emotional.
Yeah.
And it would mean that he wouldn't stop there. He wouldn't stop at the politically correct applause line.
As long as it's an exchange with Hillary. When you think about the clips that really make it to the highlight reel the next day, it's always an exchange with the other candidate. It's not an exchange with the moderators, really, right. With the exception of the Megyn Kelly event.
Yeah.
But even then, it's really an exchange with the back and forth. And I've said this before, but it's worth repeating. We haven't seen Donald Trump on the stage one-on-one. He's never had a one-on-one debate. He backs out of debates when he feels like he's going to be in a one-on-one. The only item that we have to suggest how Donald Trump performs when somebody's really out to get him is that debate against Marco Rubio, where he really went for the jugular. He knew he had to go for the jugular and went after him with a variety of lines that were extemporaneous, half-practiced, but kind of delivered in an extemporaneous fashion, and he just got smoked. Donald Trump looked like a deer in headlights, and he did not perform especially well, and I really feel like we're gonna get that Donald Trump on that stage. He's going to come there and say, you know, I'm just going to wing this thing, and Hillary Clinton's going to develop this line or use this line that she's been developing over 6 weeks, and it's just going to undo him.
Yeah. Now, of course, she could just cough and that'll be the end of it.
Yes. If she sweats or she sort of, you know, stumbles a little bit.
Remember, it's 90 minutes without a break. So, you know, she doesn't get to go to the bathroom and she can't cough and she can't stumble and she can't, you know, so she... It's sort of a low bar for most people, and one assumes that, you know, but she could still, if you take the story at face value, she could still be in recovery from pneumonia. If you don't take the story at face value, she could be dealing with other things.
But you got to think she has a line prepared for that, too, in the event that she does show some sort of a symptom and he goes after that, or at least intimates that he's going to go after that. You got to think she's got to
have some sort of response. Line about stamina. I mean, she's got to have a line to say, you know, to praise her own stamina. But, you know, there is the danger that she's been preparing for this so much. She's going to have so many alternative option ideas in her head for if this happens, then I'm going to say this. And if that happens, option 7A, I have line 8B. And, you know, anybody can get bollocksed up if you're, like, trying to keep all that stuff in your head. You know, it's not so simple. Anyway, the whole point is, don't worry about what is said in the aftermath and the gaming of the judges and who did this and who. There'll be a snap poll, and if the snap poll says that somebody won by 25 points the way the snap poll said Romney won in the first debate, then someone will win by 25 points. The real question is, if nobody wins, if it's like looks like it's a draw, does that help or hurt either of them? And I would say it helps Hillary if it's a draw. If it's a draw, because the line is, well, she should have won, but she didn't, so it was really, really kind of a draw, she still remains the more thinkable presidential candidate. And it's a draw because he wasn't able to knock her out, but she wasn't able to knock him out either. But her goal... Anyway, I don't know. That's my... But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe then he looks more plausible to the... undecideds who will break for him.
Well, how does Hillary lose? Like, I mean, really lose? Like, have another 9/11 post 9/11 weekend where she
could look
out.
Confused. She could look overprepared. She could lose her temper at the wrong moment. She could, you know, she
could come across as shockingly insincere. I mean, if she overthinks what she has to do, if she's she does on the attack poorly. Yeah.
Also, all of her debates have been intra-Democratic Party debates. Not that his haven't only been intra-Republican
Party
debates.
Well, Rick Lazio is the famous example.
Right, but that was a weird debate. Like, so Lazio had a gimmick, and she parried the gimmick, right? So Lazio went over to hand her a document, and she acted like he was violating her personal space. And so that was all anybody knew, because this was Mike Murphy's gimmick, that Lazio was going to make her sign some play. I can't remember what it was about. And she didn't do it, which is why it was a stupid idea to begin with. She was still going to win that race, though. She won by 25 points. It wasn't because of the debate. Again, these debates matter a lot less than people think they do.
And when she debated Barack Obama, around the time that he was, it came to light that he had sort of, you know, cribbed someone else's speech about just words, mm-hmm. and she had come in with that prepared line. That's not change you can believe in. That's change you can Xerox. And it fell flat because it was
so prepared.
Right, and she can, you know, if she can't make prepared things seem spontaneous. She doesn't have that talent.
Yeah. Well, it's very rare that these things are spontaneous anyway. They almost never are. And when they were sort of invented, when these spontaneous moments were invented, when Reagan said, "I paid for this microphone, Mr. Breen," or, you know, he said, "There you go again," or he said, "I will not, you know, for the purposes of this election, you know, capitalize on my rival's youth and inexperience." That was new, so it was only, you know, that was a new trick, and now it's like, you know, the other question is in the attack mode, in the "I'm attacking you" mode, there's never been a moment to rival, you know, Senator, you know, Jack Kennedy. That was 28 years ago. Lloyd Benson did that. And Dan Quayle, by the way, being not a able or nimble person, should have been prepared for that too. They decided they were going to say, it was in the press all week, that they were going to say, "He's 41 years old, just like John Kennedy. He was in the Senate for 12 years. He did this, he did that. I have the same experience as John Kennedy." Somebody better at debate prep would have said, "Well, Benson's going to say, oh, you're comparing yourself to John Kennedy?" And then Quayle could say, "I would never compare myself to John Kennedy. He was a war hero and a great American, and a tragic thing happened to him, but I will compare, but I would place my experience next to his experience as a politician," or something like that. But what he said was, "That's uncalled for," right? So that was like, I lose, you know, but those one-on-one moments almost never work. That's the whole thing. These debates matter less than people think they do. And also they matter. This one matters less because these are two, because like, who doesn't have an opinion of these people now?
Well, that's what I think.
Dukakis, nobody knew Dukakis in 88. No. And Dukakis' first answer was about whether or not, you know, what he would do if his wife were raped and murdered. No one had ever seen him before. No one had seen Bush and Gore, even though they were both very faint, you know. Now, this is like some kind of weird, you know, exhibition game between the, you know, between the Yankees and the Mets or something. Like, everybody in New York City knows everybody on the team, you know.
That's an interesting point. And we said, you know, Hillary's experience has been in a Democratic primary, and Donald Trump is going to try to out-Democrat her, in a sense. When she proposes X program, he's going to propose another X program. When she says, you know, "I have $250 billion in infrastructure spending," he's going to say, "I have $500 billion, which is actually a true proposal. And he's actually, you know, saying how much he's going to spend more
on
stimulus.
And why shouldn't he? Because then his entire amen chorus on the right is going to go, "That's good. I mean, you know, people don't want conservatism anymore. So it's fine that he wants to spend $500 billion on infrastructure and create a new entitlement."
Or they'll say,
I mean, Rush Limbaugh, the paragon, the Solon of conservatism, announcing to the world that conservatism no longer matters
anymore.
Right. Or they'll say, "You see what he did there. He said what he had to say."
Yeah, because you know, right. you know he doesn't mean it.
Right.
But that's all postgame. And if there is a theme to this podcast today, it's that we're really building up the expectations of how much this debate matters, because there is this bizarre presumption in the commentariat that the race is close.
Right.
It's not close.
Right. It's closer than people thought it was going to be.
A five-point race is not a close race.
No, but it was close because it was an 8 or 9 point race 4 weeks ago, and now it's a 5 point race. And so the idea was he was dead. Everybody thought he was dead after Khazir Khan. He was dead. What was he going to do? So it turned out if he just shut up, and then bad news happened to her, the race would tighten. So again, if she doesn't cough and she doesn't get any really bad news between now and November, it should be okay for her. And if you like Trump, that's bad news. And if you hate Trump, that's good news. Or if you hate Trump and Hillary, it's very awkward and confusing news and you don't know where to go with it. But that's where we are, and that's where we're going to come to a close here on this, our first of our twice weekly podcasts. We did one on Wednesday, we've done one today, we're going to do two next week, we'll probably do one Tuesday after the debates, and then one maybe Thursday or Friday. Commentarymagazine.com, please go there, get some free reads, get your subscription for $19.99 or $29.99, like us on Facebook at Commentary. Follow our Twitter feed at Commentary, @commentary. I'm J. Podhoritz at Commentary. Noah is Noah C. Rothman at Commentary. Abe is
Abe Greenwald.
Abe Greenwald. Very simple.
Yes.
Our Twitter feeds are really interesting. Noah's is very news-based. I do a lot of insults. And Abe cracks a joke every now and then. Thanks for listening, and we will be back to you next week.